Okay.
Are you okay with that, Kimberly?
Yeah, so there's a in Soto Zen temples, the way they call people together to do meditation practice is with something called a han, which is this big sort of like board. Only it's really thick, maybe about a couple, 3, 4 inches thick, and about maybe 18 inches wide, maybe about a foot high, or maybe 24 inches wide. And they hit it with a mallet, and so when someone's striking the han, and there's a certain rhythm to how they strike the han, it's time to go to the zendo, the place where you sit zazen. So at Green Gulch, the han had been in use for a long time, and so there was like almost there's a crater that had almost gone through the entire han. So you can imagine how many times you have to hit a mallet against a big thick piece of wood for this to happen. And there's something written on the han. It took me a while to figure out what was written on the han. But I put it together, and it said something like, "Don't waste time, contemplate the great matter of life and death. Don't waste time, contemplate the great matter of life and death." So this is very much on our minds right now because of the death of April's daughter, which is, of course, why she's not here. The reason Brian's not here. But all day today, I found myself thinking about death from beginning of the day through the entire day. And it seemed kind of morbid in a certain way. I'm having some health issues. And so I was thinking, I wonder if I'm going to see the next fall. And there's just like a heavy, I was heavy all day. I was just like dragging myself slow, heavy, thinking about it. But it wasn't until, I don't know, maybe 3 o'clock, something like that April called and told us what had happened. And I realized within a few minutes after talking to her that because she and I are so close, that I'd been feeling what was going on without knowing that's what I was feeling. And so I thought it was about me, of course. And maybe it is about me, I don't know. But at least in the immediacy, it wasn't about me. And when we talked to April, she said, around the time that her daughter was in the accident, but before she died, she just got cold. She could not get warm. She just got cold, 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 and could not get warm and started feeling empty. But she didn't get, she knew something was off, but she didn't know what it was. So what this reinforces for me, what it reminds me of, is the way that we're all connected with each other in ways we often just don't have any idea of at all. And yet, there it is, and sometimes something happens that really, really lets you know that, kind of indubitably. And so I then sometimes for myself will wonder, okay, so I mean, really, being in touch with people seems like what we really all want. I mean, we all want to be, we say, we feel at some level, we want to be kind of connected with each other. And yet at some level, we kind of deny it, resist it, kind of separate. But we're all in this thing together. So this is not exactly the talk that I had in mind when I was thinking about what I was going to talk about this evening. But this is what I want to talk about this evening. Is the whole issue, as Buddhists see it, of life and death. Because it seems totally necessary to talk about that this evening. So I don't want to be morbid or be, you know, whatever. But it's what's up for me. And this is an obviously significant theme in Buddhism, in Buddhist philosophy, in Buddhist practice. And it goes back right to the time of the Buddha, this particular issue of from one way of looking at it, is there something that exists after death? Do I exist after death? Does some part of me exist after death? And then there's another way of looking at it, which has to do with what's going on with life. I mean, the two kind of connect with each other, although sometimes I think that we don't think about that, certainly not as modern people. We don't think about that. And as Americans, it's said that we ignore death. We don't want to have anything to do with it. We pretend like it's not going to happen. We push it out of the way, and we don't want to, you know, we sort of sanitize everything. Kay remarked that on her first trip to India, one of the things that she saw most distinctly was everything was out there. I mean, it was just like everything was out there, life, death, the whole thing, you know, starving people, robust people, animals doing everything, everybody in the road, the whole thing. And but it was refreshing because it was real, unlike sort of the situation that we're in. Except in a funny way, I don't know that that's true, because the thing that I've always wondered about with this culture is the main form of entertainment that we have is death. I mean, if you turn on the television, most of what the dramas are about are somebody getting killed, or somebody got killed and you solved the mystery, or, you know, killing, being killed, dying. That seems to occupy a lot of TV time in certain ways. And apparently now, and that's true for movies also, and apparently games are now a bigger deal than a lot of movies. I mean, just in terms of the economics of gaming. But most of gaming, as far as I can tell, is about boom, you know, shoot, blow up, simulation of killing. So there's something that's on our minds that is there. So Buddhists have talked about this for a long time, and usually we think that Buddhists talk about this from the point of view of reincarnation, which is sort of a key concept in Buddhism. And we think, most of us, that what that means is that after I die, I'm reborn in some way, as another person, or as another being, or in another realm, or something like that. If you actually look into history of Buddhist thought, if you look into the literature, you find that in the great monasteries, the main teachers, because there's this long monastic tradition that comes out of India into Tibet, whatnot, China, Japan. The great teachers have left commentaries behind, who are the people who are really read and studied by Buddhist practitioners, have had a lot to say about this. But what's interesting is they often don't agree with each other in what they say about what happens when you die. Now, in the West, like with the Catholic Church, they got it all sorted out. It's like, here's the doctrine, this is the way it is, this is what we all know, this is what we all believe, and that's sort of like the way it is. Maybe that's not the way it is for the scholars, what theology, but for the general, church membership, that's sort of the way it is. Buddhism is really very different, because the Buddha is known to have said, and this is a tradition that was passed forward, is known to have said, don't take anything on the basis of belief because I said it, or because some great person said something. You have to test everything out for yourself. Decide for yourself what you believe and what you don't believe. Subject everything to close analysis. Meditate and look closely at things from your own experience, and then determine what you think the truth to be. Well, of course, then you end up with a lot of different ideas, with great teachers saying different kinds of things. So then, in the Buddhist tradition, somehow this had to get reconciled, because how can it be that Saint so-and-so says that when you die, this happens, and Saint thus-and-such says that when you die, the other thing happens? And they're both the equivalent of saints, and very wise and venerable, and but they don't agree with each other. So what's going on? So the way historically Buddhist teachers have dealt with this issue is in the context of saying, well, you've got to look for yourself at what's going on. And so they take a different route into the question. They take a different angle to get to the question of what gets reborn. And part of it has to do not with, or maybe not just part of it, let me put it this way. The route into answering this question has to do not with what gets reborn, it has to do with who is it that's here right now. Because to think about what's going to happen to me in the future when I die depends upon thinking about and understanding clearly what am I now. Because you can't possibly understand your future if you don't understand what you are in the present. So the place that Buddhists begin with the question of life and death and what happens with death is not with death, but with life. And then they say the way to deal with the apparent contradictions in the teaching and to resolve all questions is to ask the question of what am I? What am I really now? And if you can get at the answer to that, then you can get at the answer of what survives, if anything. Because in the Buddhist context, and now this is sort of like to reference what we talked about last week, in the Buddhist context, the reason for there's a reason why we can't actually answer the question right now of what am I now, let alone what will happen to me in the future, because we don't know. I mean, maybe it's rash to say this, but my guess is that that if I knew who or what I really was, I wouldn't have started studying Buddhist philosophy. I mean, that was part of the reason that I got interested. I mean, I'm not sure all the reasons that, you know, Kay was drawn into it, but I know the death of her former husband, Kay was widowed when I met her, that, you know, that experience had a lot to do with why being connected into Buddhist practice and sort of Buddhist lifestyle. And so I suppose it might be rash to say this, but in some way it probably is fair to say that if you really, truly, actually knew who you were, what you were, and, you know, how you lived in the deepest sense, you wouldn't be here. I mean, that if you're here, that means there's a question. I'm just taking that for granted, that there's an interest in something other than the ordinary hey, let's have a beer and watch football kind of life, that there's something else that's being sought. So I don't know, maybe it's rash of me to say that, but I'm going to kind of make the assumption something else is going on. So back to this question of if I want to know the future of my existence, I need to understand the present of my existence. And so what is it that's missing? What is it that's not understood? So the Buddha was very practical when he addressed this question. He was very practical. He didn't really say, I'm enlightened and I know everything, and so let me tell you what's really going on. This is what's going on. Just believe me and everything's going to be cool. And he actually didn't do that. At least if he did, I'm not aware of his having. Well, maybe he did sometimes. But mostly what he did was he said, let's take a look at what your experience is. If you want to know what you are and where you're going, let's take a look at what your experience is as a person. And said, everyone feels like they're a person. Everyone feels I'm the subject of my experience. I'm the author of my experience. I'm the one to whom things happen. I'm the one, and in ancient India, it was taken for granted, and I'm the one who's going to get reborn in the future. Because in ancient India, reincarnation was the basic view of reality. Just as in America, in 2009, except maybe for Christian America, the basic view of most people is when I die, it's all over. There's nothing going to be happening. That was my father's view. My father just was, yeah, we're here. When we die, it's all over. You know, but I think that's a pretty common point of view among people. Well, maybe a lot of people have that point of view, but they wish that they had a different point of view. It's like, well, that's kind of what I believe, but I really wish that somebody could convince me something else was going on, you know. Or, I believe something else is going on, mostly, but then I have these niggling doubts. But, I mean, so there's this whole range of stuff. Anyway, so the Buddha said, let's start with this person, I, this sense of I, and look really closely at what that I is. And we'll ask some questions, and we'll see where it goes when we start asking those questions. So, last time this event was happening, because I don't even know what to call what it is that's going on here on Sunday night, on the flyer that Kate put together, we call it Study and Meditation Group. So, but I don't know what's going on here. I mean, that's what's happening. But there's no good handle for what's happening here. This isn't a church. This is my living room. This is Kay's living room. We're all just sort of sitting here. Anyway, so the Buddha started asking people around him questions. Like, okay, do you think you're the same as your body, or do you think you're not the same as your body? And then the people around him would answer those questions. Some people would say, well, I'm obviously the same as my body. And he'd say, well, okay, so if that's the case, what happens if you lose your arm? Well, but have you changed or has your body changed? Well, usually the answer to that is my body's changed, I haven't changed. And so then the Buddha would say, well, then you and your body are two different things, aren't they? Oh, okay, I guess me and my body are two different things, because if I lost my arm, I'm still me, just my body has changed. Okay, so if you and your body are two different things, then would you exist without your body in some way? Anyway, I'm not going to go too far down that particular line of reasoning. But he would ask these kinds of questions, and he would ask people to investigate these kinds of questions. So, 2 weeks ago, I was saying that in Buddhist tradition, the way that Buddhism is taught, or the way people practice, is they start by studying or listening to somebody teach, and then they're asked to go off and think about what they've been reading or hearing, like think about it, analyze, and then they're asked to sit and meditate on what that was, to try and get at a deeper understanding of what that was. So, Kay is going to use me as a prop in a little bit to demonstrate proper meditation posture, the 7-point Dorochina posture. I'm not probably a really good prop because, actually, I'm sloppy, but anyhow, better than nothing. And then she'll introduce some basic kind of focusing meditation. But her idea is that in time we get more into specific kind of practices beyond just sort of being aware of your body and sort of sitting properly in your breath and like how to calm down and whatnot. But what that's all about, I mean, it's nice to sit and get calm, but what that's all about really is to prepare yourself to begin to look more closely at the question of what am I? Who am I? What am I really made of? And this kind of thing. So where this goes in basic Buddhist thought, just to sort of do a preliminary, and we'll cycle around on this for quite a while, because it turns... I mean, this is obviously not an easy question to get answered. If it was an easy question to get answered, we'd have the answer and be no particular problem. So what the Buddha taught was what's sometimes called the analysis into five skandhas, is the Sanskrit term, which just means the five heaps or the five piles. And it refers to experience. What he invited his students to do was to look at each moment of their experience and identify it in a certain way. You know, like, what's happening here? What is my experience? And what people observed, or at least what the Buddha observed, and therefore what his students tended to look for, depending on how you want to look at these things, was that there were basically five coarse categories, or five piles of similar types of experience. Like everything in one pile is like, this is similar, this is similar, this is similar, this is similar, this is similar. And he asked people in the process of doing this to see if they could find their subjective I, the thing that they thought they were worried about, you know, what's going to be born in the future, to find it in any one of those five piles of experience, because that I ought to be in there. I mean, if it's going to be reborn in the future, then it has to be real in the present. And if it's real in the present, then you ought to be able to identify it in some way. So he said, so let's take a look at what experience is. And so one thing that they found is that some experiences are of the material world, or of matter, stuff, things, like physical things, like body, you know, the earth around us, these kinds of things. That we see things, that we hear things, that we taste things, we smell things, we can feel things. That of the five senses, that, you know, there's some commonality. It's like there is this thing. There is this experience. I should say not this thing. There is this experience, but it's connected with something material, whether you're hearing it, seeing it, smelling it, tasting it, touching it, whatever the case may be. So there's one pile of things. But then there's another pile of things, which is feelings, not emotions, not sentiment, but another pile of things, which are feelings. And what that meant was we find that we're either attracted to some things in that material pile, or we're repelled by things in that material pile, or we have some sort of combination of attraction and repulsion at the same time to the things that are in the material pile. Like, for example, it's fall today. obviously it's fall today. I mean, the trees are turning gold. You can see that for the first time in the last couple of days. And so part of me looks at that and says, wow, beautiful. So that's a feeling of attraction. And part of me looks at that and says, oh, yuck, winter's on the way. I'm an L.A. boy, right? So I'm not a big fan of winter. Bare trees and snow doesn't ring my bell. It really doesn't. You know, I put up with it. So when I look at the experience of fall, when I look at the leaves, it's like, on the one hand, it's very beautiful, but then there's this whole other kind of level, which is sort of like some part of me is feeling like, oh, gosh, here we go again. So I spend my day running around, you know, insulating cracks between windows and thinking about all that kind of stuff. And so I could say that my feelings are actually a combination of the two, if I was honest. I'm both attracted to the beauty of fall and repelled by the experience because it says winter to me. So those are feelings. Those three things are feelings. That's what Buddhists mean by feelings. And those are really different than the material things that we have feelings about. So that's a different pile. Because feelings aren't material. I mean, attraction is not a material thing, and yet it's a real experience. So there's that. And then there's another pile of experience, which is sort of recognition of the nature of experience, perception, if you want to use that language, which is when you notice that all your experience is the coming together of myself as a subject that's aware, and a material something that's out there, and then a sense organ that's an intermediary, you recognize that what your experience is really is perception, that these things are all coming together. When I look at the leaves, there's something out there, but there's me here that's aware, and there's my eye, which allows me to see. So that experience of perception is somewhat different, because it's not material alone, because there's something non-material happening, which is awareness. And yet it's not totally non-material, because it depends upon something physical that's out there. And it also depends upon a sense organ. So they say, okay, so here's another category entirely, which is what is perception, perceptual experience, which is different than attraction and repulsion because it has nothing to do with I want more, I want less. It's just recognizing the nature of experience. And then he says, now if you look at perception really closely, what you find is that you don't have just plain old perception. That everything that you perceive, there's something else going on. There are thoughts about what you're perceiving. There's attitudes toward it. There's memories associated with it. Sort of like, I look at those leaves, and I remember huge piles of golden leaves when I was a kid that I could jump into and roll around and all that kind of stuff. Well, so what's a memory? Well, a memory is different than a perception because there's no material thing out there that I'm being aware of. I'm aware of a memory, but there's no material thing there. Attraction or repulsion may be associated with it, but that's different than it. So here's the fourth pile, which is all this mental stuff that occurs when perception occurs. And then there's one thing that's missing that we haven't talked about that, in a sense, pervades all of this but is different than all of this, which is awareness. And you can have perception, and you can have attraction, repulsion, and so on and so forth. And awareness or consciousness is associated with that. It's part of the experience at some level. But it's different than that. And the other thing is that there are many things in the pile of what are called sort of like mental formations, like memory and so on and so forth. And there are different feelings, like attraction, repulsion, combination of the two, and there are different material things. But there's only one kind of consciousness, which is interesting. There's consciousness, or there isn't consciousness. There can be more or less. It can be sharp, dull, anything like that. But awareness is awareness. There's not, I mean, it's not divisible in any particular way. So without belaboring this, because this is something for observation, and what the Buddhist teaching does is it says, look at this place. Look at these five piles. Just take your experience and take a look at those five piles and see if there's anything in your experience that doesn't fit into those five piles. Can you come up with anything that doesn't fit into those five piles? Is there anything else? So then, what led us into this question was, so where's the I in all of this? Where's the me in all of this? Because the question was, where's the me that gets reborn in the future or doesn't get reborn, that lives and then dies? This is the big question of life and death that the Zen priests are saying, pay attention to this. So where is I in all of this? And that's then a very interesting question, because if I is the body, then everything that's in the matter skanda, the matter pile, that would cover it. But that doesn't work, because there's all this other stuff that isn't the body. And if I was just consciousness, which some people tend to think if I was just consciousness, that might seem like that's a good answer, except for the fact that without the body, it doesn't show up. I mean, I doesn't show up without a body that it references. So now we have this question, this interesting problem. It's like, okay, I'm looking for the I in all the realm of experience. I have these five handles for looking at all this realm of experience. So where is the I? Is it inside of that? Is it on top of that? Is it outside of it? If you put all the five together, is that where the I comes from? So the Buddha didn't exactly ever answer that question. He said more, if you look for the I in relationship to your experience really closely in this way, that you can't find it, except as an idea, maybe. You have the idea, I. But that's not what we mean when we talk about I. When we talk about I, we mean something like something real. A little somebody that's like, you know, sitting inside of here, or the same size as my body, kind of layered over it, or somehow, you know what I'm saying? It's like, I is just an idea, doesn't cut it for most of us. So, he asks that we do that investigation. So, if you can find the I in this, he says, then you'll find the answer to the question of what lives and is reborn, or doesn't live and is reborn. Now, in a certain way, this is an extremely unsatisfactory answer to the question, because we would like an answer. I mean, it's kind of like, wouldn't it? It's kind of nice to have the Pope tell you what the truth of the matter is, and then you don't have to think about it. It's sort of what I'm saying. But there's no Buddhist Pope who's going to do that. I mean, even the Dalai Lama, who some people say is like the Buddhist Pope, which is totally not true, but is somebody who commands great respect and has, you know, really deep wisdom. I mean, he'll tell you what Buddhist thought on these various things is, but he'll always, someplace in the process, say something like, yeah, well, that's what's in the scriptures, but, okay, you asked me, so here's what's in the scriptures, but you really have to check it out for yourself, because if you don't check it out for yourself, then that's just a whole bunch of words. So, check it out. And this is how you check it out. And so this is the place where Buddhists start with checking it out. And this is based upon what you find when you begin to investigate this. Then you find the answer to, you know, that, you know, why did they write this on the Han to contemplate the great matter of life and death? What is that? And then that begins to emerge. And the question is asked in the Zendo. It's asked in the meditation hall. It's like it's on the Han that's being beaten, you know, as in come to the meditation hall and ask yourself this question. And by the way, if you don't know how profound this is, notice that you can hardly read this statement because we've been beaten on the Han for so long and so much time has passed, we've pretty much worn our way through this big hunk of wood. So, time is passing. Time is passing. So, that's kind of what I had to say tonight. And we can, you know, do Q&A after a while if you have questions. I would hope you have questions. But mostly, I wanted to go this route out of affection for April, who really took Kay and I under her wing when we came to this town and became our good, deep friend. And this issue of why it was that I could feel her pain today without even knowing that she was feeling it is also tied up in this question. Because if you can get at what is that I and what are the limits or not the limits of that I, then you also get at the why it is I could be so broken by what her experience was when I didn't even know she was having an experience. Because there's some place where our I keeps us apart, but our deeper something connects. And so that's another part of this question of where is that deeper something that connects and what's that all about, which is revealed when the misunderstandings about the I are kind of put out of the way. So this is for her. And there is a Zen tradition when somebody dies, that their name is put on the altar. And so we've done that. Lara's name is on the altar there. And so our thoughts and our hopes and our deep feelings are with April and Brian and the family as they go through all of this. And I hope that she'll listen to this recording at some point, and this will begin to be helpful in some way, just as a little beginning. That's all. Yeah. Oh. Yes. Yeah. Because Teresa's so tied in. Yeah. All right. So let me turn this thing off now.
Okay. Let's see if I can.
It hasn't stopped.